Thank you, Your Honors. Paul Rufine, registration number 19948, appearing on behalf of the Forest View Acres Water District. As noted by the panel, there are appeals and cross appeals with, I think, 9 distinct issues to be argued before the panel. Despite that, I would like to attempt to reserve 2 to 3 minutes for rebuttal, and will structure my argument in an effort to do so. There are many issues before the panel, many issues to discuss, all of which stem essentially from what's been coined as the 1985 agreement. That agreement is between the Water District and the Nevins.
The record includes the evident testimony from negotiators in state.
It does not. In fact, in 1985, the Water District and the Nevins were essentially one and the same. Hugh Nevins founded the area, Red Rock Ranch, which is now incorporated within the Forest View Acres Water District. Hugh Nevins ran the district. He was part of the board. He was also part of Red Rock Ranch, Inc. The district, Hugh Nevins himself, and Red Rock Ranch were the signatories. Mr. Nevins is deceased. The only testimony presented from the Nevins' side was from Hugh Nevins' daughter-in-law, Penny Nevins, and she expressly stated that she was not involved in the discussion regarding the agreement. She was, in fact, not the daughter-in-law in 1985 and had limited knowledge of the workings of the agreement from 1985 to the present. She was essentially the liaison between the Nevins family and the Water District, which is why she took a lead role and a testifying role in the case, but there was absolutely no testimony presented as to the intent of the parties.
Any evidence in the record as to the fees or charges that existed in 1985?
Very limited as to 1985. There were water service charges for actual water used. Those were the only fees charged by the district at that time. The rate is uncertain. As the records go back, there were not a lot of customers. Water bills or testimony was not presented regarding the 1985 structure. I believe the latest testimony that existed was Mr. Tom Gunther, who was a former president of the Water District, whose history dated back as far as the mid to late 90s, and he established what was the water structure from that point forward, including the addition of, again, a coined term in this case, the subsequent fees, or the additional fees that are beyond actual water service, water use charges. Fees such as debt service, enterprise fees, capital fees that were instigated by the district and carry forward today.
Are any of the subsequent fees prorated on the basis of water usage, or are they per capita by subscriber?
They are per capita by subscriber, wholly distinct from the water usage, which has always been a per gallon rate.
In fact, the trial court said they wouldn't be entitled to any recovery for the water service fee for under 15,000 gallons a month. Is that correct?
That was the finding of the trial court, yes, that the subject paragraph within the 1985 agreement, where 98% or more probably of the discussion has been placed, states that Mr. Nevins, the 1985 agreement is a very broad agreement dealing with essentially the transfer from Hugh Nevins to the Water District. Infrastructure is conveyed, financing agreements set forth, water rights dealt with. Because Hugh had been there, he owned multiple properties and was going to retain those within the district, there is a provision within the 1985 agreement that reserves certain rights to the Nevins. Among those is the designation of 4 physical tap connections to the water system. One of those, it is undisputed, is the plaintiff's property. Now, Mr. Wild owns one of those designated taps. That is not in dispute. The other portion of that subparagraph 4 that is referred to reserves water use rights to Mr. Nevins. That is the district's position, and a point of contention on appeal as to whether that particular right was unique to the Nevins and could be assigned beyond the Nevins' heirs. There is no dispute that Hugh Nevins assigned that right to his son, Gary, and daughter-in-law, Penny. they retain that right as is required or allowed under the 1985 agreement. The water use right and the district's first issue on appeal is whether that particular right was specific and unique to the Nevins because of the unique relationship between Hugh Nevins and the district, or whether that could be also assigned to Mr. Wild and now subsequently from Mr. Wild to any other subsequent assignee.
Why couldn't it be? I mean, after all, in Colorado, normally we allow assignability of rights unless it's personal services or there's a second exception.
And I don't believe there is an express exception in Colorado law. The analogy drawn by the district is that it places a perpetual restriction akin to a covenant on this property where the district will be obligated to give free water forever and ever.
And that's impermissible. Why?
Because the law disfavors those types of covenants absent an express intent.
Absent an express intent. Okay.
And I believe that that intent exists here. In initial ruling, the trial court also agreed that that perpetual restriction was not allowed. That was in relation to the preliminary injunction, clearly preliminary in nature, but did establish the arguments that the district relies upon now. And as regards intent, it is the distinction between the taps, the points of connection, which could be assigned because it's a one-time connection. They don't get disconnected and reconnected as property gets sold. That just doesn't happen. But the agreement, by its plain meaning, draws a distinction, and the water usage under 15,000 gallons is specific to the Nevins.
Well, wait a second. Doesn't it talk about that at the last clause of the agreement that the parties, their heirs and assigns will be bound by this agreement?
It does.
So why would their assigns not get the benefit of the agreement?
Their Mr. Nevins' assigns did. Gary and Penny did receive benefit from the agreement. The district's position is that that assignment then ended that right because there was no longer an heir or assign of Hugh Nevins to receive that particular right. And then as a matter of law, that assignment stopped.
Are you aware of any authority that indicates assignments are a one-time thing only?
No.
Assignments can't be remote at all?
I am not. The assignment law in Colorado hinges on the intent of the parties and what was the intent. And the jury in this case did make a factual finding where Penny Nevins did state that she assigned or intended the assignment to Mr. Wild. The district argument is a question purely as a matter of law as to whether the plain meaning within the agreement itself drew that line and drew that demarcation because of the unique nature between Mr. Nevins and the district. From that, we go to the plain meaning of what that provision means itself. And the district contends that it says what it says, and that the taps and the holder of those taps would be subject to all district rules and regulations. Mr. Wild attempts to read that subsequent language regarding the 15,000 gallons of free water to be a restriction as to the only applicable rule and regulation. The district contends that the language is exactly the opposite. All rules and regulations of the district apply to those taps with one single exception, and that is for water use up to 15,000 gallons, there will be no charge. If Mr. Wild is an assignee under the agreement, those are the rights he obtained. That's what the plain meaning of the statute has. I stated earlier that about 98% of the focus at trial and in the briefing and even in the pleadings before the trial court have been focused on that section, subsection 4. I've been guilty of doing the same, but I need to point out to the court that there is a subsequent section, Roman numeral 3, subsection 5, which immediately follows and states that all fees of the district will be charged and will be paid, with an exception as to standby charges. We're not dealing with standby charges here. We're dealing with the subsequently adopted and lawfully imposed rules and regulations of the district that impose fees upon Mr. Wild, if he is an assignee, as a customer of the district.
Did either party ever argue in the district court that that this particular provision about liability for fees and charges was ambiguous?
There was early argument during the preliminary injunction phase. During that, the trial court found that there was certain levels of ambiguity. There were motions immediately after that ruling seeking clarification from the trial judge. Based upon that clarification, the trial court had found that there was ambiguity and no further argument was made there.
Why did the parties then leave the matter of interpreting that clause to the trial court without presenting any evidence as to help the trial court discern the meaning of the ambiguous language?
I think the ambiguity had been crystallized to the point where it really focused on the assignment. And that's where the ambiguity was. And that was the issue that did go forward and evidence was presented and taken to the jury. The issue regarding applicability of rules and regulations and subsequent fees was discussed with the trial judge in the context of jury instructions. And based upon that dialogue, the prior rulings of the court and the proceeding of the case at that point in time, I think both sides were comfortable that as a matter of law, the trial court could make that decision.
And yet, in the arguments to the trial court, did not Mr. Wild's attorney argue that the course of conduct of the parties over the years had established that there was no expectation that the fees and charges would be assessed against Mr. Wild?
Yes,
isn't that a rule of how to resolve an ambiguity?
It is. It was not presented, I do not believe, in the context of that ambiguity. In fact, Mr. Wild's, the bulk of the case was prior course of contract, exchanges of correspondence between the district and Mr. Wild and attorneys as to whether or not it was never couched as a waiver, but I believe it was a waiver argument. That argument went forward through the jury in the context of the assignment as to whether Mr. Wild was capable of reaching those conclusions or not. Other than that, it was reserved by the trial court for a determination as to which Mr. Wild breached the agreement or not. And the trial court, with those factual findings in place, determined that, in fact, Mr. Wild also breached the agreement.
Is there any specific finding on what Judge Daly refers to as the course of dealing evidence?
Minimal. There are acknowledgments by the trial court of those exhibits. I believe the only specific finding of the trial court framed the time period with which the breaches would be considered and drew a line as of 2004. That was based upon correspondence from the district just prior to 2004 billing statements, where the district acknowledged, because it was subject to some embezzlement and record keeping was horrible and it was in a state of disarray, that it would not pursue claims prior to 2004. I believe that's the only specific mention within the trial court ruling.
Didn't the embezzlement problem end?
No, the embezzlement actually carried forward past 2004. It was just being determined that there were issues in 2004, and the board of directors, which frankly until that time had been a rather passive board, was taking a more active role and looking into issues such as audits and water billings and our customers current. And that's when the district stepped in. The actual embezzlement itself was not discovered until 2005, when in fact the embezzler was prosecuted and subsequently convicted for the embezzlement from the district. Quickly, and I know I probably will not have any reservation, but that's fine. We're dealing with both issues here a little bit. The issue of liquidated damages, I'd like to spend at least a minute discussing that. The trial court, in the district's opinion, clearly exceeded its bounds there by not making any of the requisite factual findings in order to enforce liquidated damages. In fact, the record does not contain anything regarding the intent of the parties in 1985, whether damages should be liquidated or not.
Well, there's the language of the agreement.
And the case law, specifically the Adams County case,
it says it's not conclusive. But when you say there's nothing in the record, that's not quite correct.
Fair distinction, and I apologize for being overbroad in my statement. It is not conclusive. And the intent, when subject to the entirety of the agreement, perhaps $1,000 a day or breach liquidated damages might have been applicable in debt repayment when we were talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars or the conveyance of infrastructure or the conveyance of easements, but not here, when there have not actually been any monetary damages suffered by Mr. Wild as opposed to a $1,000 a day breach claim.
Was the court advised in any argument that you wanted the court to make specific findings on those three factors?
Absolutely not. And I think it was noted in the district's opening brief in a footnote. There was discussion in the context of jury discussions regarding liquidated damages. It proved to be a misunderstanding between counsel as to what took place during those discussions. It was the district's position that it was understood liquidated damages would not be applied, and so there was no argument or request for any consideration made. From the Wild perspective, it simply did not come up in the continuation and the remainder of their presentation of evidence.
True, but they did ask for it in their closing argument.
They did. The parties were asked to submit subsequent briefs, and it was raised at that point in time.
Judge, with your permission, may I ask one question?
Certainly.
With respect to the disproportionality argument that you've made in your brief, how do we consider the prospect that Morrissey now, is it reasonably in proportion to the kinds of losses that could be expected or might actually occur? Gee, if I had to go to court to enforce my rights, in other words, attorney fees, how do they play, the potential for attorney fees, how do they play in analyzing the disproportionality of a liquidated damages clause?
I believe minimally so. I believe the standard by Colorado law is that you need to look at the time of the entering of the agreement as to the disproportionality. In 1985, while either party could project, if we have to enforce this, we would have to go to court, we would have to do attorney's fees, perhaps even liquidated damages, it can go on and on. But I believe the more reasonable interpretation is to look at the nature of the specific breaches and whether in the context of that breach, liquidated damages would be a penalty or not. It is undisputed that the most Mr. Wild could have suffered had he paid anything, which he did not, would have been $120. Just by the nature, $120 versus $1,000 is disproportionate. In reality, it was zero versus $1,000. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Pat Hrbacek, attorney registration 32567. I'd like to turn directly to the liquidated damages provisions, since that's where the court and counsel's argument was left off when they finished. We certainly agree with counsel for the district that the agreement as written was a broad agreement, and it covered lots of issues, lots of topics, because there were lots of topics to be covered. And that is one of the reasons why a liquidated damages provision was presumably considered necessary by the parties. One illustration of the fact that a liquidated damages provision was both contemplated and necessary by the parties was the fact that they excluded a certain aspect from the liquidated damages provision. There is a provision in the 1985 agreement that just precedes the liquidated damages provisions, and it had to do with certain payments that were to be exchanged. And those payments were explicitly and expressly excluded from the liquidated damages provision. And we think that is good evidence as to why the liquidated damages provision was anticipated by the parties.
Well, what about, as your adversary argues, the disproportion between billings for 15,000 gallons?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a valid point. I think what we're after in terms of looking at whether damages are difficult to prove or difficult to quantify, we're only considering one aspect of potential damages to a party if we're looking at what they would have been required to pay. That doesn't quantify the damages to Mr. Wild that were suffered as a result of the district trying to collect fees it had no right to collect. And I think we've amply illustrated some of the types of damages that were suffered by Mr. Wild in the course of history. And unfortunately, we're not talking about a course of history of 1 month or 3 months. We're talking years. And part of the issue when you're dealing with a single customer is, how do I, as a single customer, fight off charges from a district if they don't have a right to make those charges? And therefore, the damages I suffer as a customer can't be quantified in isolation in terms of what I'm required to pay, but also what I'm required to do or not do. And as the record demonstrates, and as, you know, was amply briefed, Mr. Wild suffered the exact kind of damages that one might expect if they took on the district. Ultimately, his water was shut off at a completely inopportune time. And those are the kind of damages that we can't sit here and quantify, because we don't know what they're going to look like. We don't know the time of year when the water might be shut off. We don't know if it'll be shut off. We don't know how many warnings are going to be given.
But the liquidated damages awarded for the shutoff or for the 44 billings?
They were in part ordered by and for the billings. And thank you for that question, Your Honor. And one of the reasons those were appropriate was the testimony of a district employee themselves, who admitted that it would be proper to award liquidated damages on a per billing basis if that was deemed to have happened.
There were no tort claims involved in this proceeding, were there?
No, Your Honor. There were no tort claims.
Your argument about the availability of the frustration factor, the inconvenience factor, the constant battling factor would be an item you could recover in a tort claim, would it not?
Your Honor, potentially that is true. But again, there are obstacles to overcome even in that context, in part because we're dealing with a governmental entity. So if Mr. Wild were to attempt some type of tort claim, he would have to address the Governmental Immunity Act and things of that nature. But again, I think that also comes back around to whether the damages are ultimately quantifiable or difficult to prove.
Isn't the difficulty of proving a separate element from disproportionality between the liquidated damages and...
Yes, Your Honor. I think that there's certainly two different elements at play there, but I think they also overlap in the sense of we're not dealing with an isolated situation. We're dealing with, again, a customer of a district who potentially is looking at being charged for charges that he doesn't believe are owed, and over the course of many years, the parties' performance suggest that they shouldn't have been charged. And so, looking back...
Well, let me stay with your last point. How can, if evidence of the course of dealing was presented, and at least implicitly, if not explicitly, rejected by the lower court, how can we...
I think, Your Honor, it comes into play in the sense of reviewing both the jury findings and the trial court findings, and as to whether they followed the law and whether the record supports what they found on one level. And also, to the extent there was evidence presented, it's an issue of looking at that evidence and reviewing the record to see whether the elements of liquidated damages have been met in this case. I'm not sure if that answers your question, Your Honor, but.
I think I unfairly interrupted you and went back to a point earlier made by Judge Daly. Let's set aside the liquidated damages. If your argument on what, you know, fees versus rules and regulations means depends on the course of dealing. Course of dealing evidence was presented before the lower court. At least impliedly, the lower court rejected it. How can we revisit that issue given the narrowness of our review of factual error?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think our position is that to the extent the lower court rejected that, there was clear error there, that under the course of performance, there was no ability to charge fees going forward.
And the district's response to that is we had a crooked bookkeeper, the files were a disaster, and it took us several years to get on top of that problem. Whether we find that plausible or not, isn't that a sufficient predicate in the record to sustain the lower court's decision?
On one level, Your Honor, it's certainly, I understand that the court could take that position, but I also think the agreement itself speaks to this issue in a way that the court could find that there was no basis to charge those subsequent fees.
Oh, let me ask you about this. Even in the language of the agreement itself, it talks about, your caps could be treated and subject to the rules and regulations. And in paragraph 5, it talks about that the district could collect fees except for. Well, if the only fee that existed at the time was a water service fee for which there was or could be no recovery of that fee, didn't the parties anticipate that at some point there could be some other fees that would be collectible under that provision?
I think that's entirely possible, Your Honor, but I think
isn't it not only possible, but plausible or probable? If they provide for fees, and so far the only one is a fee that you can't collect because of the very nature of it, isn't it probable that they anticipated there might be other fees that would have to be recovered in the future?
Well, Your Honor, I think part of the problem is we can't go back to 1985. And so based on the language of the agreement, we look at sections 3, sections 4, and section 5. And sections 3 and 4 are uniform in terms of talking about water without charge. There's no exception or limitation placed on that in either of those provisions. So to the extent the parties anticipated that there would be fees in the future, I think it's also plausible that they would have addressed that fact in those provisions and said it's without charge unless and until the district decides to make charges under its rules and regulations. Clearly, the parties had the ability and the willingness to talk about what would be collected and not collected and what would be charged and not charged. So the fact that they didn't do it here, I think, speaks to their intent. Turning to Section 5, I believe the language of the agreement says that the district is entitled to fees mentioned, and then it refers back up to the sections above it, sections 1 through 4. And then it accepts out a part of section 3 and 4 for standby fees. But I think it's instructive that what they're talking about in section 5, in referring back to sections 1 through 4, is most likely and most plausibly TEP fees. Because in sections 1 and 2 above, they talk about Mr. Nevin's entitlement to TEP fees for a certain number of specifically designated properties. So if you take that in context with Section 5, which then says the district will be entitled to fees other than those, that's what they're talking about, is the TAP fees.
So what you're saying is he gets a certain number of TAPs free, and any additional TAPs he wanted would be whatever the customary fee was.
Yeah, for the specific taps that were, or properties, I should say, in sections one and two. That's what the parties were talking about in section five. Because again, I think if there were fees and charges that weren't in the quote unquote rules and regulations at the time that were anticipated by the parties, they certainly had the ability and incentive to try to address that in the agreement. Again, this was a very broad agreement, covered a lot of topics. Related to this is the concept raised by the district that somehow Mr. Wild's benefit leads to a quote-unquote absurd result. And I think in the context of the agreement and the relationship of the parties, we obviously take a different position to that. This is not an absurd result when you consider the broad range of topics covered by the agreement, the fact that it's undisputed that Mr. Nevins was sort of the original developer of this district, the idea that he would retain rights or free water for four properties among many is not an absurd result. Nor is it really plausible to suggest that this one assignment rule applies. There's no indication that the district had any sort of one assignment rule on its side for any of the benefits that it received from the agreement. So we think it's implausible to suggest that somehow Mr. Wild is subject to a one assignment rule. And again, to go back to course of performance, the benefit received by Mr. Wild was written into the agreement. It was acknowledged in a recorded document in 1992. He received the benefit of that agreement from the moment he purchased the property and lived there for many years thereafter. And it was acknowledged in a letter from council in around 2001. So for all those reasons, we would suggest that Mr. Wild receiving the benefit was perfectly legitimate, logical, and part of the agreement.
Let me ask you a question in the short time you've got remaining about the apparent inconsistency in your position saying that you should get liquidated damages for breaches, but the district should not.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The basic justification has to do with the difference between how Mr. Wild was damaged and how the district might be damaged. The district's damages are completely quantifiable. To the extent
that the parties said in their agreement, they're not, essentially by adopting a liquidated damages provision.
That is correct, Your Honor, but the liquidated damages provision is meant to cover a variety of breaches that may or may not occur, and this is one type of breach. So in the context of that, we still have to abide by Colorado law. And so we still have to walk through the three requirements for a liquidated damages provision in any context. And in the context of the district's alleged damages, to the extent they were damaged, it's very quantifiable. And it always was quantifiable because you can always say, well, whatever the district's charge was that month, that's their damage. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both gentlemen for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.